The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2019 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2019. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at classicalchristian.org.
Good morning. So, let's get underway. Enough of the that awkward between sessions banter. We're on the clock now. All right. What I'd like to begin with, class, if you are roughly within two or three seats of me right here in this middle section, you're going to be a classroom. So you're on. And everyone, you're in a fishbowl because everyone else is observing. Continuing with my SeaWorld metaphor. All right. So take out this poem that you received when you arrived in class. Oh, high school juniors. And it's also, I'm the only one with a microphone here, but please be, once again, philanthropic with your voice and project. So what I'd like to do, first of all, resolve to yourself, take stock of where you're seated. Am I in this class or am I merely observing? Some of you are in this class. I'm expecting you to do this. All right. So here's what we're going to do. I'd like to read this poem, one stanza at a time, and we're going to do this Quaker style, which means I'm not going to call on you. We're going to read one stanza at a time. Just voluntarily pipe up and read a stanza when it's the next stanza to be read. You can figure out, who's going to be next. That's what I mean by Quaker style, okay, as the spirit moves. But we've just got five stanzas here. All right, so let's read it. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Okay, well, just no. The Quakers speak one at a time. And if we were in a smaller classroom, this would be less challenging. All right. So I keep on stepping out of the demonstration into the demonstration. All right. So let's reboot that. But good job for the two of you. Okay, go ahead. All right. I'd like to, let's make our way through this one more time in the same manner, but just to marinate in the poem a little bit. So same thing, if you've already spoken, then you're off the hook, but class who hasn't spoken yet, same thing, Quaker style. Let's make our way through the poem one more time.
Everything the Indians have to offer, keeps it all cataloged and filed and stored. The Indians pawn their hands.
Okay, and for the benefit of some who are just arriving who may not have this handout here, Buffalo Bill opens a pawn shop on the reservation right across the border from the liquor store. And he stays open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And the Indians come running in with jewelry, television sets, a VCR, a full-length beaded buckskin outfit it took Inez Muse 12 years to finish. Buffalo Bill takes everything the Indians have to offer, keeps it all cataloged and filed in storage room, and the Indians pawn their hands, saving the thumbs for last. They pawn their skeletons, falling endlessly from the skin, and when the last Indian has pawned everything but his heart, Buffalo Bill takes that for $20, closes up the pawn shop, paints a new sign over the old, calls his venture the Museum of Native American Cultures, charges the Indians $5 a head to enter. Okay, class, any observations about the first stanza? What's going on? Okay. Folks over there, could you hear this woman's comment? Okay. So, generous with your voice.
I feel like at first it seems relatively benign, and I'm not sure where the story is taking me. It just seems like it's setting up something, and I'm not really sure where it's going. There's no emotion at that point for me.
Okay. Good. Liquor store, maybe, are you going to hold on to this benign?
No. Right. It's terrible. It's not a border. Liquor store.
All right, yeah.
It's almost like they're building a parallelism between the liquor store and this new venture, that there's some connection between the two,
just
intervening on the side.
Okay, yeah, you're creeping ahead to stanzas, lurking ahead. What's... what's going on in this first stanza? That's good to keep in mind. Yeah. Okay. Good, yeah.
No one stays open 24/7 unless they think they're going to do business 24/7.
Okay. Anyone know anything about Buffalo Bill? Is that randomly chosen? Yes, very good. And so we have a historian of Buffalo Bill Cody here. Excellent. And his Wild West show, in the same time that Phineas Taylor Barnum was having his, this was Buffalo Bill's Wild West, and he loved to restage reenactments. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, very good. And something, class, we might have already discussed are the tropes associated with that victimizing Custer. Once you have a victim identified, then you have justification for whatever action that you want to take with your coercive force, right? So moving into the next stanza real quickly, second stanza, anything that you all notice?
Well, they were there pretty quickly. They came running
in. Okay. Good. Yeah, once again, so for the people in the back, there's pearls of wisdom up here, but I'm not sure that the pearls quite landed. okay? So is the VCR, the TV set, the jewelry, and the buckskin outfit, are they put on the same plane or differentiated by the poet? Right. Or is the, yeah, good. And you can see, if we were to press this on, you can see the poem, the poet is doing both. Deliberately, he's both conflating them and showing the absurdity of the fact that they are conflated. Okay, so moving on to, how about the fourth stanza? And I'm moving quickly here. Third stanza, third stanza, line 7 through 9.
So if your business model at the beginning seems like a falling stuff, but in the third stanza, he's taking everything, keeping it cataloged and filed. That's not how a falling stuff works. He already shows his ulterior motive, which is the reason that his plan from the beginning.
Okay. Okay, good.
I think there's also a big switch from material objects to their body parts. And that's what I
Okay. Okay, good. What's the hands? So, good. Let's back. I want to come back to that. What's going on with the hand? Before we get to the thumb.
Hands, which would make the other things with that was mentioned earlier.
Okay. I bet that the bright people back here. I mean, seriously, the clouds parted and the sunshine came down, and I bet you didn't get to bask in it. Okay, good. Now you would mention the thumb. Now we got the hands locked in, and then we got a part of the hands, the thumbs. What about thumbs?
Distinguish us from other animals.
Okay. What's the name of the poem? Can you continue that thought? What's going on with the thumbs in the poem?
They're becoming less than human.
Okay. All right. I'm just going to stop there. Shift gears a little bit. We could keep on going here. One thing I might be tempted to do in the last maybe about 10 minutes left in class, or maybe I might open class with this. Anyone identify this? All right. Anyone know what his name is? Excellent. There's a controversy afoot about Chief Wahoo. And what's the point of this? So that they can hear in the back.
To make the point that we wouldn't like it if our race was used as a mascot for a sports team either.
What do you think? This is one of the most famous advocates for Chief Wahoo, who was actually removed from the Cleveland Indians uniform in this last baseball season. by order of the commissioner of Major League Baseball. And so this is where we are today. What's the message of this political cartoon? I'm sorry. Yeah, so that they can hear you in the back. Okay. What thing is... Okay. Good. All right. So, class, we won't do this, but here's what we might do. I could do a number of things. If we were concluding our discussion, I might say, okay, last 5 minutes, you're going to adopt one of these positions and just write me a paragraph and explain it. Another thing we could do is we could have four corners of the classroom. Where are you? In which position? Chief Wahoo should remain on the Cleveland Indians uniform. The ball club should have final say, and the ball club should remove Chief Wahoo from the uniform. Point C, this is not the ball club having the final say. If the ball club doesn't remove Chief Wahoo from their uniform, the league should step in and require them to do so. League should have the final say. Or, if no baseball authority removes Chief Wahoo from the Indians' uniform, City of Cleveland should step in and require them to do so. They should have the final say. All right, so line up where you are in the four corners of the class, A, B, C, D. I'm just suggesting how a teacher might do this here. And have the students try to persuade one another. And if you find yourself persuaded, walk to the corner that persuades you. Try to win people over to your position. All right. Those are, I'm playing around with different ideas, and you can tell that that's what I'm doing here. I'll put my teacher trainer hat on rather than my teacher hat on. So I am Chris Schlecht. I teach at New St. Andrews College. I actually do engage in a lot of teacher training activities. And I like to talk about class discussion. Class discussion is something that's pretty important. First of all, a comment that I'll make about the poem and how I structured the poem. First of all, what we began with, I might call tuning the orchestra. Okay, if you ever go and see Bach or Beethoven at the symphony, I don't do enough of that, but I've done it. And the first thing you hear is everyone getting in sync. There's something about hearing your own voice and making it easy, low-hanging fruit, just reading the poem. Another thing is, and this is a tough room here, this is far larger than a classroom, but if you can try to reconstruct the dynamics of the classroom, what I called it Quaker style, but getting used to speaking into a quiet space and creating that dynamic, that's part of tuning the orchestra. Okay, if I were to have started by calling on everybody, there's a dependency that the classroom dynamic fosters that I want to, and I want to get myself out of that which they're, I don't want to be the crutch. They need to discuss. And so there are certain things that I was actually doing there and other things that I was avoiding doing. One of the things that many of you did very, very natural was you spoke so that who could hear you? Me. Okay. I corrected that sometimes. It's tougher in this room. But it's really interesting to watch how teachers reinforce the idea to the students that they don't have to listen to one another. And you can tell that you're training students that they don't have to listen to one another if you let them get away with the private conversation space rather than, I don't think so-and-so could hear you. I mean, you spoke so that I could hear you because you weren't thinking about the other people who you're projecting to. So those are just some initial things. I've got more to say about that. But some introductory thoughts. By the way, I'm working from page 126 of your notebooks, and I'll I'm roughly following that. I want to begin with some preliminaries. What is discussion? I want to begin by talking about something that is just kind of, I'm kind of anal and fussy, and so I need to talk about the word Socratic and Socratic method. See, now really by training and by affection, I'm a historian, and what Socrates does in his dialogues is horrible teaching technique. Now, the word Socratic gets thrown around a lot, and if it means having a good discussion, as we will talk about here, then I am all for it, although that I am all for is not what actually Socrates did. So what Socrates did was say something really erudite, and then he's got an interlocutor who says, unquestionably, Socrates, and here's something else that's very erudite, and then which is it, this way or that way? And the interlocutor, well, it's this way, Socrates, and then he says something else erudite. It's very clear that the interlocutors are stage props for Socrates to espouse his brilliance. And Plato's dialogues, or if you've read Plato's dialogues, right, that's a horrible teaching technique. That's a horrible teaching technique. The word Socratic gets thrown around, and I just need to make my historical corrective. If by Socratic you mean that in some sort of ahistorical sense of actually having a good discussion, okay, then I'm all for it. But don't pretend that you're imitating Socrates. So there you go. I told you, that's just me being fussy. Being terribly fussy. I kind of wince when people say, Socratic discussion. The historian in me is, no, that's not what Socrates did. using your students as stage props is not in the teacher show is not good teaching technique. And I see it happen all the time when I do classroom observations, by the way. More on that later. I have as a bullet point there, distinguishing discussion from the teacher conducting a series of one-on-one conversations. A discussion involves not just teacher and student. A discussion involves student to student. Discussion involves student to student, and that's what Socrates didn't do. Okay. Do you as teachers take pedagogical advantage of the fact that there are other bodies in the room, and do you leverage that as the students interact with and respond to one another? I see what passes for discussion so often, I've got more to say about this later, but if the teacher is speaking every other time, you're not having a discussion. Okay, you're having, I don't know, the teacher is hitting is on one side of the net, the class is on the other. Think about that dynamic. That's not how a discussion works. Okay, and again, this is preliminary and I'll elaborate on this. But I want to say, I've got a remark here in the outline, discussion is fundamental. I want you to think about what discussion really is. Discussion is the very environment in which learning takes place. Now, discussion, I think, needs to be kind of trained and learned, but it occupies a unique place in a classroom, unlike other things that need to be trained and learned. Discussion is like ice skating to hockey. A good hockey coach, how much does he spend on ice skating lessons? No, it's sort of a prerequisite that's kind of a given upon which other things then can occur. Okay, discussion lies more at the plate tectonics level. Discussion isn't the lesson. Discussion is more fundamental, more foundational than that. Discussion is swimming to the polo player, the art of swimming. It's the living room furniture. It's the living room furniture that you never pay attention. You just sit down and you have a chat or you have a drink or you're in the living room. Discussion is the living room furniture itself. Okay, and just like we need to pay attention to what's on the walls in the classroom, we need to pay attention to the decor of the classroom, and we can actually stifle or foster a learning environment by our attention to discussion. But it's something, again, it's at the plate tectonics level, which makes it very important. And it's important that we pay attention to it. But one of the mistakes of paying attention to it is thinking of discussion itself as the lesson rather than the foundation upon which lessons are built. Okay. And so we need to regard it and think about it that way. And in thinking about it that way, that will help us to avoid a lot of the common mistakes. We might think the lesson's not getting through, the students are not getting engaged. There's something about the environment that you've created that's subterranean that's the problem. And it's an environmental culture. We are human beings. And God created us so that it's not good for us to be alone. And of course, that fundamental society is the marriage relationship, as you know. But moving out from that, we have families and we have political society and so forth. And a classroom is a community. A classroom is a community, and people belong together. People were not made to fly solo. Okay, your students were not made to be autodidacts. Your students were made to learn within the context of a cohort. That's part of the fabric of bearing the image of a triune God. That's who the students are. That's who the students are, and we can work with that and exploit and take advantage of that and foster that in beautiful ways, or we can undermine that in all kinds of ways. But this is a deeper level thing than simply the lesson planning. And so, and that's what we're paying attention to here. The community of the classroom, if you're going to meet with your students in third period every day, you are creating a culture through the habits and the routines. The topics are going to move on. This can be the American West, and I wouldn't introduce the Cleveland Indians. I live in Idaho, and so I might talk about the history of the American West. You guys can talk about the Cherokee removal here in Georgia. But nonetheless, I might be talking about the American West. I might have been talking about the Peloponnesian War several months earlier. And there's a relationship between those two. In the environment that I create, in the habits and routines and mannerisms of the culture, and is it a culture that fosters a community of learning or one that undermines a community of learning? Again, back to the plate tectonics. We're not talking about lesson planning. This is one of the reasons why when I do classroom observations, administrators bring me in and they want me to observe some classes and make some comments, and I enjoy doing that. But I'll insist on being sure that I'm there a few minutes before the class session begins. How the teacher interacts with and moves into the lesson, transitions from greeting in the hallway and the banter and getting down to the lesson, tell me probably 60% of what I'm going to observe that might be worthwhile. Okay. Because it's going to tell me about the environment and the students. I'll watch the students' habits. Habits are formed through enculturation, expectations. What do the students just automatically do and what are they given to do? So there's a lot of things to observe, but then this discussion, the way they think about one another and interact with one another, and the way they interact with the teachers is something that you can see in kind of the assumptions of how they've been enculturated. It's when the culture comes out. Okay? So it often talks about routine things, and it's basically the community dynamics that I'm looking for. The community dynamics. All right, so discussion is fundamental. So discussions are unlike problem sets. They're unlike papers or tests or quizzes. Discussion is a fundamentally human social behavior. Okay, it's a fundamentally human social behavior. And it's the foundation upon which other productive activities like tests can happen. All right. So we could have some other discussions here. So I have some other people in class. Student 1, student 2, student 3, you know who you are. You're going to have to bellow here. So here's another class discussion. I want you to think about this and pay attention and speak up so that you all hear. And if you don't, and just a few of you know that I'm talking to you, right? All right. So, class, when was the Battle of Hastings?
1066.
And what was at stake in the battle? Right, William won. So it was a transition from the Anglo-Saxon era to what era?
The English era?
No, the Norman era. It was the transition from the Anglo-Saxon era to the Norman era. And what changes did the Normans introduce into England? That's right, a lot of new words came into the language. We moved from Anglo-Saxon to Middle English. Also, French became the language of court for some 200 years. And what else changed?
Architecture.
Exactly. William launched a building program that introduced new architectural styles, the Romanesque and then or the Norman styles, from the continent into England. How about the way William ruled? Yes, the Domesday Book. But the thing is, William had all the local thanes and barons swear fealty to him. This is important because he wanted to make sure that he was at the top of the food chain when it came to political power. Okay, so what, if you could follow that, that was what I see in a lot of schools, and I think it was a horrible discussion. You guys are good. I had to give you a script because you're good people, and in order to give a bad example, I needed to coerce it out of you because you guys would have had a good discussion if you were left to yourselves. Okay, but I want to think about why. Okay, why? What was problematic about that discussion? Well, first of all, I was speaking every other time. Second of all, I was moving forward with the point that I wanted to get across regardless of what the students said. Students gave a right answer, and I said right, and I repeated the answer, and I elaborated it and said it with greater elaboration than the students' right answer. Students gave a wrong answer, it did not matter how I responded. Did you catch that? I gave the right answer with more elaboration. Okay. Now, the optical illusion that teachers can fall into here is when they, by the time it gets on to October and November, the students clam up. It's because the students have been trained. The students have been trained that they are like the seals at SeaWorld. Arp, 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 and then teach, you give some ridiculous problem. In what year? Okay, 1066. The teacher's just moving forward, and again, the students learn their role is to be stage props. Teacher's doing his thing, and I'm not an active agent in the classroom. My role is to be the prop. And okay, I'll stand here and be the tree because I have learned that role. What I do and what I say doesn't change the course of what the teacher says, what the teacher articulates. Moreover, I also know that I don't have to listen to my fellow students. Why? Because the right answer is going to always come out of the teacher's mouth. Why pay attention? The teacher's going to say it right and better. I don't ever need to pay attention to my classmates. And so when it's my turn to speak, I'm not expecting them to pay attention to me either, and so I'm just fulfilling the teacher's need to talk in the presence of a prop. And that's what you just witnessed. Does that make sense? Okay. One of the bad habits that teachers fall into then is repeating correct answers. If a student says something correct, then you should react so as to lead the rest of the students in the way they should react to a right answer. I'm one of them, and I'm modeling how to react to a right answer. And then sometimes, you know, I'll do silly things like somebody says something right, and I want to underscore it. I'll say something like, "Did you hear what she said? Did you get that down?" If I was a student in Schleck's class, I'd be sure to get that down, what she said, and the students start paying attention, and they'll say, "What'd you say? Say it again." I'm not going to repeat it. I might, if it's really or something that I want to underscore. That's the technique that I'll use to get the students to say it. Did you hear what she said? Did you write that down? If you were going to write it down, how would you write it down? And you notice that I'm training the students to be in community. I am not teaching, at that moment, I'm not teaching the Norman Conquest. I'm reinforcing a certain living room furniture arrangement, a certain culture, right? And when you have students who don't contribute or just kind of perfunctorily contribute, by November and December, you've trained them that that's their role. It's a habit that was formed. Think about the habits that you're forming. Another one is the teacher repeating the quiet student for everyone to hear. And that reinforces what I call the private conversation space. You all know how space works, right? If I'm talking to a group like this, and I'm talking to a group like this here, and it's kind of awkward, isn't it? The awkwardness reveals that there's a culture of how you stand in proximity to other people, and you can do that with your voice. It's unfortunate that I'm mic'd here, but... And I'll put this back so that I don't have to keep yelling like that. Although it was kind of fun. And I see it all the time. The kids in the front will speak as if they are conversational with the teacher in the front, in proximity like me to you. If this were a classroom, it'd be me to you. Never let that student get away with the conversational voice. And what I'll do is I'll say, "You back there, did you hear what she said? You didn't hear what you said. I think you need to say it again. I'm not going to repeat it. Okay. But you know, the teacher can say, even with a right answer that's articulated by a junior high kid, it's going to be kind of muddled and uncrisp, and the teacher can say it with greater succinctness. The teacher can say it with greater clarity. Isn't that true? Which is why you need to say the right answers all the time. You need to, that's a common instinct. That wasn't clear. You recognize that. The students are immature, and their immaturity is coming out. They're offering an answer that wasn't necessarily wrong or right, but it wasn't crisp, clean. And so you're going to ride in on the white horse and say it in the crisp, clean way. And you have trained the whole class that, you know, the teacher's going to give us the answers. And I don't need to, I'm not responsible for the concept. There is a huge cost, and it's cultural in the classroom. Okay? And the cost is in the culture that you're creating. I don't care what the lesson is. But I need to get through the material. I need to get through all of those things. And it comes at a cost. It comes at a cost. So you got through the material by speaking through it and speaking over your kids. Seriously, what did you accomplish? And then the dutiful kids will repeat it back on the quiz and they'll get hundreds because they're dutiful kids and they studied what you said. And what did they really get out of it? I mean, it was intellectual bulimia. They binged on teacher notes and vomited onto your quiz. And you think, because they all scored well on that quiz, that you were a good teacher. When the students were never given responsibility and agency for the concept. And it's in the culture of how you interact with them. All right. Sometimes I get mad when I think about this. All right. I want to try to give you, I've tried to give you the warning signs, the things that I look for in classroom observations when I critique teachers. Those are the things that I notice. There's a bigger right than getting the right answer. Are you having the students be the agents in their own learning? That's a pretty fundamental question. It's a pretty fundamental question. And that's so much more important than getting blank number 3 on the quiz, right? I mean, we're classical educators, and we know what that means. I'll have more to say about that in a session that I'm doing later this afternoon. But that's what's at stake. So, Schlecht, how these are some of the watch signs to avoid. So what are some good things to do? And I've got some ideas for you. And that one was one. Okay. That one was one where you just divide the, you know, physically stand up, and the kids are going to argue with one another, discuss and persuade one another to the different corners of the room. Some of you have seen that. I've seen that. It's kind of kitschy. You know, it's a gimmick. Hey, some cliches are true. It's a good gimmick. Now, if that's your go-to every time, the students will bore of it, come up with other gimmicks. But that's a good one. That's a good one. And the students are required to listen to one another, persuade or not with one another, and there's ways of executing that. Another one that I want to call attention to, back to the handout on the flip side of the poem, I want to explain this rubric. This is something that I think is good for the maybe junior high level coming up into early high school. And what I'll do is I'll divide the class in half, and I might, you know, you could call this inner circle, outer circle. There are half the class is discussants, and half the other half is the observers. And I'll physically organize the class so that you have the people around facing one another. Those are the discussants, and then kind of on the outskirts, on the wings, are the observers. And each observer is observing one discussant. Okay? And we're going to have a discussion, and the discussants are discussing. So maybe you got a class of 20 kids. 10 are discussants, 10 are observers. Halfway through the class, you're going to switch roles, and you're going to have another discussion. And the observers have a rubric like this. This is something that I've used for older students. You can pare it down. You can make it half the size. You can come up with your own things. But so rate the discussion or the discussant. So, like, you know, maybe you are, what's your name? Belinda. So Belinda's the discussant. You're the observer. And so you're going to write your name, observer, and you're observing Belinda. Did Belinda come prepared? Speak audibly. Speak comprehensively. Stay on topic. Etc. So you see that, then you know you follow. I love this is always fun. Down at point B, name the discussant who best met the criteria above. Was it Belinda or was it one of the other nine? You know, and you're going to rate them, and then you're paying attention and following, and you can see the other questions that I have there. Down to the final question, which is to offer your own reflection on the point of the discussion. You can, of course, vary this, but here's the point. Here's what's happening. This works at the same principle of a peer review on written work, and I want to talk about peer review of written work to make the analogy to here. So I'm a big fan of having the students pass their papers to their classmates and review their classmates' work and offer feedback. Now, the optical illusion is that that's a benefit to the author because the author is getting input on their writing. That's the optical illusion. The real benefit is to put them in the seat of the critic so they start to notice things. And it's by putting them in the seat of the critic, you know, they'll notice the missed connections and the ambiguities in someone else's writing and start to build up those muscles of noticing. And then when they turn to their own work, they can start to see what they were blind to in their own work. Put them in the... So I'm a big fan of peer review of written work for that reason. And it's always the benefit of the critic, although they think that they're giving a benefit to the author. Does that make sense? The same thing applies here then. That's the principle here. They're learning how to discuss, but what makes a good discussion? They're paying attention to this, and so then it's when it's their turn to discuss, they've got maybe some more tools to think about and attempt and that sort of thing. So this insert, I might use this rubric once or twice, in the first 2 weeks, and then I'll put it away, and then I'll revive it 2 months later. If you do this, that's tiresome, but don't do that. No, this is kind of a one-off teaching tool. This can become a ball and chain if you think as a one-stop shopping sort of thing, right? We just want to train up the students to think about certain things, and this puts them, it forces them to think about certain. That's another thing you might consider trying. Another one, and this is if you see the annotation key. You can have the students, and this is below the poem here on the handout. You can come up with your own variation of this. There's nothing magic to this, but put students in the role of tracking the discussion. This is another way of observing. It's not the rubric, but what I will have them do is on a sheet of paper, they will list... they'll follow the discussion by Sonia, Bob, just one line of the next, and they're paying attention to what Sonia says, and then, Bob speaks, and then Fred speaks, and then Frida speaks. And so they're going to write the names down, and then they're going to identify what that person's posture was in relation to the previous speaker or something earlier in the conversation. So the plus, you see pluses, checks, and X's. Pluses mean they're agreeing with somebody. Checks mean they're ambivalent with regard to somebody else, and X's mean disagreement. Okay? It's younger students often think that the only way to contribute is to disagree. They're, you know, and then it's got to be bold, it's got to be combative. The array of, there are lots of ways to contribute, that's one. And in fact, there's lots of ways of disagreeing. And just to have students observe and they start paying attention, there's agreement with a previous speaker. And here, well, and I should elaborate what I have them do. Their pages are numbered, and so Bob speaks, and maybe he's not reacting to the previous speaker, but three speakers ahead. And so I'll say, line three plus R. And so you can follow a conversation like that, right? Oh, this person speaking up and is hearkening back to two persons earlier and agreeing with their point, but elaborating with new evidence, right? And once again, the benefit is when it comes their time to speak, maybe I can further the conversation by agreeing, not just by disagreeing, but by agreeing, but then pointing to something else in the text that reinforces the same point. Maybe I can, and you see, and you get the idea. Or I'm disagreeing because of the form of the reasoning. I'm disagreeing because the facts are wrong. I'm just, you know, there's different ways of disagreeing. And you're tuning the student's reasoning abilities, and that's going to help them articulate. Again, to be the observer, like this. Now, when you're discussing, you're not doing this. That's when you're in the role of the observer. So that's another technique that you can do and incorporate from time to time. If you make them do it all the time, then it becomes this albatross across the neck. Don't turn it into an albatross. It's a teaching tool for a one and two off kind of thing, right? And then revisit it in another month to kind of remind and refresh. And then it'll become easier to, oh, this is going to be another day we're going to do the rubric thing. All right, so those are a couple of possibilities here. Another possibility that I think, and a lot of people are aware of this one, small groups, group A, group B, group C, group D. So we've got this poem, or maybe I can have five groups. We've got five stanzas. And so here's what I might do. We're going to read this poem. Students walk into class, five groups, A, B, C, D. What you need to do in the group is identify two concrete images in the stanza. And for each of those concrete images in the stanza assigned to you, stanza one, stanza two, the five groups, five stanzas, two concrete images in the stanza, and what is its significance or what is its role in the context of the entire poem? How does that image serve the poem? And as a group, come, and then you're going to report back to the whole group. And so that's a little workshop in the small groups, gets everyone active. Okay. And then we'll bring it to the larger group. And okay, first stanza people. That gets the students engaged, working. It eliminates the wallflowers. It's a very different dynamic than the whole class. It's just so easy to do, and it's really effective. And there's lots of different ways to do that. That's how I might have just handled this poem, a different approach. Mix it up, gets the students engaged. The best classes are when you see a buzz and hum of student activity, not the buzz and hum of teacher activity. The buzz and hum of student activity is what you're looking for. It's always what you're looking for, because learning is something that students do. Learning is not something that you do. Teaching is about students and what students are doing. And if students are not active, then learning's not happening. Okay? It's not the teacher show. It's about the work that the students are doing. So that's the small group. Small group folding into big groups. When I do the small group, big group thing, I like to have a summative activity, like the last 5 minutes of class. Last 5 minutes of class, okay, prompt, seat work prompt, everyone's going to write a paragraph on some predetermined prompt, you know, or whether or not we should, you know, ban Chief Wahoo from the Cleveland Indians. tell me why one paragraph, last 5 minutes of class. What that does is it puts a period on the lesson. And let me mention another error that you want to avoid. I mean, I love to hear the sound of my own voice. And many of you are teachers, and you can probably relate to that. And maybe you got this good discussion going. And you're right in the middle of something great, and then the bell rings, and they're off to physics class. Physics. They're off to physics class. What you need to do is, if you've got a 50-minute class period, my eye is trained on that clock and the last 5 minutes, and I'm looking for the off-ramp, because whatever has happened, maybe I only got through half of what I expected to get through, or a quarter. I'm sure if you've experienced teacher, you know what I'm... Maybe you got through one-third of what you thought you were going through. The worst way to spend the last 5 minutes is to try to race through two-thirds of it. That is the absolute worst way to spend those last 5 minutes. What you need to do is, okay, you got through a third of it, at least make that stick. Redeem that time, right? And so put a period on it, connect it, cinch that knot, and because I like to get into it, I like to plan ahead of what that is, because when I'm on that road, I love the drive, and I need to have decided ahead of time that I need to take exit 63C, okay? That's part of my own self-discipline. I plan the last 5 minutes of the class so that I have an exit ramp, and oftentimes that's just as much for my own self-discipline as for the students, but it also is going to take whatever happened in the first 50 minutes, it's a 55-minute period, let's say, and I'm going to make sure that 50 minutes was redeemed and cinched and locked in. And so 5 minutes on your own opinion of Chief Wahoo or whatever. Of course, what am I going to do in the first 5 minutes of next class? Students write a paragraph in the last 5 minutes. I rifle through them, and I'm going to pick this one, this one, this one. And that's the activity for the first 5 minutes of tomorrow, is you're going to read yours, you're going to read, you know. It's just something that's really easy to do. I might not even grade them, but I gave myself exit 63C, and I needed to plan that route just for, you know, it's always for the student's benefit, but to discipline myself to get off at the exit. And to make sure that whatever we covered well. All right, so those are some thoughts on discussion, maybe hopefully some ideas of do's and don'ts problems to walk through. You all do wonderful work. Thank you. Send us your students to New St. Andrews College. Question here.
First of all, that's how Stokes would set up
this. Stokes. Yeah, the question is, what about students kind of transitioning into the dialectic? A simplified rubric. I gave you a more advanced form of a rubric, but make it simple. You know, half a page, that sort of thing. You can model, and then let them do it. But I think they need to do it too. The answer is similar to what I would say to a coach. You know, how do you get, if it's a junior high basketball team versus like a Division I basketball team, they've got to play the game. They've got to do some ball handling, but you'll have some more ball handling drills at the junior high level, even though it's the same game as Division I college, right? And so they need some of those drills. Break it down, shorter discussions probably. Very good. All right, you're a good group. Blessings to you. Our time is nigh. Thank you.
Thank you. Good. Appreciate it.